This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A few years ago, a revival of Death of a Salesman opened on Broadway, and a reporter asked two psychiatrists for a diagnosis. Willie Loman, they replied, suffered from clinical depression, and they prescribed mood-altering drugs. Playwright Arthur Miller was outraged. Loman is not a depressive, he barked. He is weighed down by life. There are social reasons for why he is where he is. That anecdote was part of a recent article in Newsweek magazine that describes the happiness industry in modern-day America and a bit of a backlash. Depression is a serious problem, of course, but sadness and melancholia have their places in our psyches, and perhaps we might want to think twice before we resort to pills or aerobics to battle just the blues. Have you ever felt pressure to get happy? Do you see the value in the occasional episode of sadness? Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also tell us your story on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later this Valentine's Day, we'll talk with New York Times film critic A.O. Scott about the sad state of the American romantic comedy, and we'll remember Steve Gerber, who created Howard the Duck. But first, in defense of sadness, and we begin with Eric Wilson, an English professor at Wake Forest University, author of the book Against Happiness in Praise of Melancholy, and he's with us today from member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And you say that, melancholy is something that we need to experience from time to time. There are certainly occasions in our life when it's perfectly appropriate.
In my experience, melancholy has led to revelations of self and new ideas that I never would have come across had I been happy, had I simply been content with how things are. So for me, melancholy is a deep longing for a richer relationship to those around us and the world around us.
And how do you know if you're happy if you haven't been sad?
Well, I, in my book, actually distinguish between happiness and joy. For me, happiness, at least as it often manifests itself in America, is a desire for contentment, a desire to find tranquility and comfort in the world. Whereas as joy grows out of melancholy, the two go hand in hand. We can think of times when we've had the most profound experiences of our life, like witnessing a birth or getting married or being in a funeral. And at those times, there's this really interesting mix of joy and sorrow. We often laugh and cry at the same time. We feel almost as if our body will burst by trying to hold these two opposites together.
Yet you did come up against some resistance in your insistence that, well, sadness is good at times.
I have. I think many people wonder if I'm perversely questioning the American dream. The idea is, I think for most people, that America is the land where most anything can happen, a utopia where we can find material wealth and perfect happiness. Also, a lot of people think I'm rather wantonly wallowing in sadness, as if I'm telling people that they should go out and try to find sadness.
Well, I'm sure that's not your prescription in this particular context. And yet there are entire industries built around the idea of that contentment you're talking about, happiness.
Obviously, in our culture right now, many people who are simply moderately sad or even mildly sad are often given antidepressants rather quickly. I fear that this practice will cut off an integral part of life, and that is sadness. To go through life desiring only happiness without sadness is like desiring all up with no down, all day with no night, and that can lead to a rather attenuated existence.
At the same time, I'm sure you've heard the criticism that it's like the Cubs fan who says he won't enjoy the winning without the many, well, near century of failure. It'll make the winning all the more sweet when it happens.
That is really what my book's about exactly, that the way to appreciate life, the way to keep from taking life for granted, is to embrace the rough spots. You need the rough spots. You need the bad occasions to teach you really how satisfying your life is when it's not so bad.
And as you suggest, it's played a role not just in your creativity, but in the creativity of, well, many of our best-known artists.
Well, certainly. In my book, I discuss the lives and the works of several great artists and leaders and scientists even. I think mainly of someone like John Keats, early 19th century British poet who suffered the loss of his mother when he was a young man to tuberculosis, suffered the loss of his father, he fell from a horse, suffered the loss of his brother himself, worked in some of London's hospitals as a young man before anesthesia. So he lived a rather dark, brooding life. But he came to the conclusion that we need this melancholy really to appreciate the world's beauty. We only appreciate the beauty of, say, a flower or a rose when we know it's going to die. We realize how fragile and tender it is. So when we experience a flower's beauty, we feel sorrow at its passing, but also a kind of exuberance with the vitality that it shows us. This was a main idea in Keats's poetry that he explored over and over again.
We're talking with Eric Wilson, author of Against Happiness in Praise of Melancholy. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Anne is with us from Camillus in New York.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for this wonderful conversation you're having.
You're welcome.
I was wondering if your guest could make a comment on age and how it affects your emotional well-being and what the difference is between emotional exuberance, maybe would be a good word to say, and melancholy. Is there one in same or... are there two separate definitions?
Eric Wilson, what do you think?
Well, I'll try to comment first on the first part of the question, and that is what does age have to do with my ideas? Mm-hmm. As I have gotten older, have felt more sorrow as my body has started to decay and as I've felt my possibilities for living mm-hmm. to narrow. But at the same time, in becoming more mature and having a family and having a daughter, I feel there's been a deepening and an enrichment of my life. My suspicion is that the older one gets, the more deeply attached one can become to the world, but also probably the sadder one gets, knowing that life isn't going to last forever.
Right.
Now, the second part of your question, is there, if I'm understanding you correctly, is there is emotional exuberance the same as melancholy? Is that what you're asking?
No. Would you define them separately? Would you define someone who demonstrates their emotions? I was accused, unfortunately, by a family member of being a Tammy Faye, being, you know, quick to cry.
Right.
I am not in my youth. I'm in my senior years, ultra senior years, and I do find that my emotions peak at any kind of emotional experience.
Well, we're sure you've got better mascara than she does. But anyway, what do you think, Eric?
My book is a defense of exactly what you're talking about. I think the honest expression of emotion is often downplayed in our society. It's often mocked in any case.
Right.
It seems to me that when you feel deep emotion, you're having a really intense experience of one kind or another.
Right.
Sometimes sorrow is attached to it. Sometimes joy is attached to it. Mm-hmm. And one should be able to express that fully. That in my mind leads to an authentic existence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I would say cry on.
That's what I think too. Yes.
And thanks very much.
Don't ask it.
Thanks very much, Anne.
Thank you. A wonderful show, as always.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
Let's go now to line five and Nicholas. Nicholas from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a good present for Valentine's Day.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just calling because I was telling your screener that my father passed. It was about 7 years ago, and it was very suddenly, and we're really close. And I went through, you know, a normal period of grief and sort of worked with those emotions, but I find just in the most random times, like when I'm doing dishes or something, I'll get like this itch and I'll start thinking about him. And I have always been told to sort of work through it and think positive thoughts, but I find it's actually more cathartic if I just give myself a really good, just like ballyhoo, if I just cry and sort of even like think almost negative thoughts to spur even more crying. But then once I'm done, I feel cleansed and I'm sort of ready to move on.
A good cry, well, the catharsis of a good cry has long been documented, don't you think, Eric Wilson?
Yes. I really feel best in my life when I feel this profound sense of loss, loss of people that I've loved, loss of youth. And when I allow myself to feel that loss, I too often feel that kind of catharsis, the idea being that if you experience your sadness fully, It's not as if you'll purge it from your system, but you'll move to another state. And that's what makes me say that sadness always leads to growth. You almost are inspired to relate to your condition in a new way if you've really been patient with your sadness and sat with it a long time. And I feel best in some ways when I am sad. I feel most alive when I'm sad.
I was just going to say, I could understand feeling alive when you're sad. I could understand that sense of everything being vivid, but you feel best when you're sad?
But yeah, it's kind of a tangible feeling, I think. It's something, it's almost like there's more of a concrete foundation in that. Like, it's almost more understandable. I think that people sometimes inherently mistrust happiness, but sadness you sort of understand. I don't know. That's sort of my take. I'm almost mistrustful of people that say they never cry.
Well, there is this new concept that some of the psychologists are exploring called depressive realism. And the idea is that people who are prone to sadness, melancholy, even depression, have a more realistic view of the world and therefore can judge the world more accurately.
Nicholas, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil. You guys take care.
So long. And I just wanted to ask you, are there times when you wake up and say, well, I'm feeling pretty good today. I wonder what's wrong with me?
I wouldn't quite put it that way. I would say some mornings I wake up and I'm very happy to see my daughter. I'm very happy to be with my wife. I'm happy to pop in a Cary Grant film, for instance, and I feel pretty satisfied at that point. But I don't think I would really have a feeling of the texture of that satisfaction if it weren't related to my my melancholy, which is a kind of ongoing sense that life hurts, life's painful. It makes me appreciate those nice moments all the more.
Eric Wilson, thanks very much for being with us, and have a perfectly miserable Valentine's Day.
I'll do my best. Thank you so much.
Eric Wilson, an English professor at Wake Forest University. His book is titled Against Happiness, In Praise of Melancholy. He was with us today from member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Not everything has to be happy. Take Kierkegaard, for example, or the band Poison's masterpiece, Every Rose Has Its Thorn. We're defending sadness this hour. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Go ahead, rent Love Story. Reread a separate piece. Listen to Barbara's Adagio for Strings. It's okay to cry. This hour we're singing the praises forlornly of sadness. It's in a happiness-obsessed culture, of course. In a minute, we'll talk about the continuum of the blues from sadness to depression, what's normal. But we want to hear from you. Do you see value in the occasional episode of sadness? Did it help you finish your novel, write that love song? You're invited to join us at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now is Jerome Wakefield, university professor at New York University and author of the book The Loss of Sadness, How Psychiatry Transformed Normal Sorrow into Depressive Disorder. And he joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Great to be here, Neil.
And is there a stigma against sadness?
I think, oddly enough, whereas psychiatrists and mental health professionals have always talked about the stigma of mental disorder, we have a growing stigma for feeling intense sadness. Partly this is a result of the mental health professions themselves having redefined depressive disorder so that it encompasses an enormous range of intense human emotions, some of which I think are normal. And so we have a narrowing of the acceptable range of human emotional functioning, leading to the kind of thing that your listeners have been mentioning, where sadness itself is unacceptable. It seems stigmatized.
And again, we want to point out, of course, depression can be a very serious illness.
Absolutely. This is the first thing one has to say, that depression is a serious illness. It can even be life-threatening. If one has a depressive disorder, one should seek treatment. One should seek consultation if one is in doubt. The issue we're talking about is a different one, namely that the continuum from depressive disorder through to normal sadness is being muddied and fuzzied up in a way by the way psychiatry is diagnosing depressive disorder, to the point where if you go into your general practitioner and mention that you have a few symptoms of intense sadness, you're feeling blue, you're having trouble sleeping perhaps, maybe your appetite has waned, you're a bit distracted, and you don't feel like doing your normal roles, your normal work, you will probably these days be offered the option of medication without exploring the context. And that's the key, the context of your feelings. Are your feelings a natural, normal response to some real loss, some real stress in your life or not?
I wanted to read an email we got from an anonymous emailer in Indiana. Last July, my 8-year-old daughter died of cancer. I'm experiencing the worst pain I've ever known. I'm also growing spiritually, emotionally, more than I ever thought possible. I will make it through this, and I will come out on the other side a much, much stronger, more compassionate, wiser person. As I now say, we don't grow when we are comfortable.
Absolutely. It's interesting because I hear so many of these stories. The fact of the matter is that sadness is a biologically designed response. We know that other primates become sad when they lose various things. Infants become sad, and they have the same kinds of hormonal reactions that we do when we lose something that we love. So sadness is giving you information that something you really care about, some part of the meaning of your life, is challenged or lost. And withdrawing, feeling these feelings, focusing on it is a way to reconstruct your life. And very often people do say that in reconstructing themselves internally, they end up stronger. So this does have a function. And for many people, this is an extreme case, but for many people, they feel that it's benefited them to go through it and deal with it rather than, for instance, medicate it away.
Is there, do you think, an evolutionary purpose for sadness?
Well, I think it's unquestionable that there is some evolutionary purpose because it's clearly, as I mentioned before, it's been evolutionarily shaped. We see that primates sulk and withdraw, and they have the same hormonal reactions we do when, for instance, they lose a dominant struggle, they lose status in their group, or perhaps some other primate close to them is lost. So just like we feel depressed when things go badly at work, we lose status, we're humiliated, or we lose a relationship. That's probably the single most highly predictive event for sadness, intense sadness and grief. Why do we have this built into us? Oh, and let me just mention, cross-culturally, every culture experiences sadness. The facial expressions that people have are the same. If you tell stories about loss and ask how would you react, they give the same kinds of sadness responses. So this is clearly a response that transcends cultural shaping and is part of our biological heritage. Apparently, I mean, there's a lot of theories of why we have this response, and it's still controversial. I mean, one obvious theory is that by withdrawing, we avoid harming ourselves, continuing down a disappointing road, making assumptions that no longer hold, and we're able to reconstruct our meaning system and our life and move on in a more constructive way. To put it in simple terms, if you go back to that primate situation, if a primate has lost a dominant struggle and goes off sulking and feels sad for a while and then comes back into the group, they're not likely to get killed. Whereas if they continue to struggle without withdrawing, they are likely to get into a violent situation.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Diana. Diana with us from Vallejo in California.
Yes. Hi. So glad you took my call.
I'm glad you called. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm calling to just have a comment about cross-cultural variation and how appropriate it is to display sadness. And I'm personally from Iran, but having studied medical anthropology and the whole field of ethnopsychiatry, there is plenty of literature that backs up looking at, you know, how the idea of looking sad, thoughtful, and a little melancholic is not only stigmatized but expected of people who have experience and people who have lived a life, a full life, and know what life is about, and as opposed to the way we have it here in the United States, where, you know, you're expected to smile all the time if not something is wrong. It's quite opposite, actually, in other cultures.
I think this is an excellent point, and it's really true that in some other cultures, if you don't show enough sadness, there's a suspicion that you don't have a deep commitment to whatever has been lost, such as a person, if somebody's died, and so on. And in fact, sadness is a complicated state that tells us that things that are meaningful to us, that we value, have been lost or changed, and that we have to adapt. And so it's understandable that people use sadness as an indicator of the degree to which you are actually embracing these meanings in life sincerely. It's true that in our culture, on the other hand, we tend to be impatient, snap out of it, get on with
right.
it, and
Correctly.
So on.
Thanks very much for the call, Diana.
Sure. Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye. That's interesting, the snap out of it part. Periods of mourning, for example, it comes as a surprise to Americans that in cultures there's a year is a normal period of mourning.
That's right. Many cultures have periods where you really aren't supposed to do anything else. You're supposed to withdraw from your normal commitments. And the periods are much lengthier than ours. You know, in our psychiatric diagnostic manual for normal bereavement after you lose a loved one, it only allows 2 months, 2 months of intense grief. After that, you're considered to have a mental disorder because your grief has gone on too long. And it seems to many people that that's just not realistic about how human beings function and how they're naturally designed to be when they lose someone that is close to them, that's been part of the meaning of their life, through which they've seen as a prism their whole life and its meaning. This kind of reconstruction of your life takes time. And I think, again, we need to be aware that in the name of efficiency, we shouldn't start narrowing the range of normal human emotion, which we can tolerate.
Let's get Jim on the line. Jim's calling us from Bowling Green in Ohio.
Yes, thanks. This is a good show. I'm happy to be listening to it.
Thank you.
I've got a question about kids. We're talking about mourning and everything. And I heard a sociologist once say that if you'd ask most of today's parents, they would say they wanted their kids to be happy. But if you would ask a generation ago, they would have said they wanted their kids to be good. And I have kids myself, and that sort of sets up a tension. You know, do I want them to be happy, or do I want them to, you know, grow up strong and good? And I'm just wondering about your comment on that.
Well, I think these aren't as distant as it might seem at first. Happiness can be defined in a more, how shall I say, superficial way as just a feeling, a good feeling, which we'd all like to have. Goodness, of course, doesn't have to be defined as just following the rules. Goodness can be defined.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello? Oh, go ahead. I thought we lost you there for a second, Mr. Wakefield.
No, I'm still there.
No, Mr. Wakefield, go ahead.
No, I do think that there is a correspondence between happiness and goodness, but sometimes it's like we don't want kids to fail. We sort of protect them from, you know, pain. And when they do fall down, it's like, oh, get up, don't cry, don't, you know, get over it. So it sort of sets up a difficult time with kids trying to get them to be happy and good at the same time.
Okay, Jim, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, thanks.
There was an interesting part of the Newsweek article that inspired our conversation today. It was called Happiness Enough Already. In surveys of 118,519 people from 96 countries, scientists examined how various levels of subjective well-being matched up with income, education, political participation, volunteer activities, and close relationships. They also analyzed how different levels of happiness, as reported by college students, correlated with various outcomes. Even allowing for imprecision in people's self-reported self of well-being, the results were unambiguous. The highest levels of happiness go along with the most stable, longest, and most contented relationships. That is, even a little discontent with your partner can nudge you to look around for someone else until you are at best a serial monogamist and at worst never in a loving, stable relationship. But if you have positive illusions about your partner, which goes along with the highest levels of happiness, you're more likely to commit to an intimate relationship, which is an interesting study. And again, they went on to talk about the question, the value of happiness, and people who reported themselves at a 10 were much less stable and less successful than those who reported themselves at 7 or 8. It's an interesting article, again, from Newsweek magazine, and it's called happiness enough already. We're having technical difficulties with our bureau in New York. We could try to get Jerome Wakefield on the line with us shortly. In the meantime, I'll read a couple of emails we've gotten some from. Oh, we've got Jerome Wakefield back.
Yes. Neil, can I finish answering that call?
You certainly can, and I apologize for our technical
problems. That's okay. I just thought it's a very important point because ever since the Greeks and Greek philosophy, there's been an attempt to understand how happiness and good life go together. I think one thing one can understand readily is that sadness gives us information about whether the deepest values and meanings we have are being realized. And therefore, I think a good life in the sense of a life that's searching for meaning, that's pursuing goals, that's pursuing great projects that we believe in, can be a life of happiness, of contentment, because meaning and happiness do tend to go together. But of course, then you have to define happiness not just as a good feeling come what may, but as the satisfaction that your deepest values and goals are being realized, which I think is what a good life is about.
And we've mentioned this already, but it bears repeating. This from an email we got from Susan. Do not discount the realness and horror of clinical depression. There's no doubt I gained a great deal after correct treatment for a terrible clinical depression panic disorder, but I would never wish this experience on anyone. Please, please, please make the distinction between sadness and clinical depression. There's a huge difference between mildly sad or moderately sad and clinical depression. We certainly do respect the fact clinical depression is a very serious, potentially fatal disease that does need treatment. We're talking today about sadness. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Elizabeth. Elizabeth's calling us from New York.
Hi. I have suffered from serious illness in my life, especially when I was in a child and in my teens. And I have a brother who didn't suffer at all. And the amount of achievement that I've been able to, I mean, facing that sadness early on in life, really, that suffering really honed me into a much more developed person. And, you know, my brother's only a year younger than me, and he's achieved much less because his idea of life is far less challenging.
Right. You know, it's an interesting thing. Just take a simple analogy, the analogy to physical pleasure and pain. If somebody said, I just want a life of pleasure, no pain at all, we'd certainly understand that. All of us strive for that. But the fact of the matter is that those people who happen to be born with a genetic anomaly where they feel no pain, there are people like that, they die early because they don't know how to get away from danger. They step on a foot that might be broken. They don't feel the pain. They don't turn over in bed at night when their blood isn't flowing and most of us feel discomfort. And so they end up dying early. What you need is pain to tell you when to get away from something and to orient you, and pleasure to bring you toward what's meaningful and good. And now emotions like happiness and sadness are much, much more complicated, but there is the analogy that you not only need happiness to give you a sense of contentment, yes, I'm heading in the right direction, you also need occasional sadness to tell you this isn't the right direction and to motivate you to pursue what you value, to tell you what you do value. And I think that's what this kind of call indicates, the value of having a balance of both to orient you in life in a meaningful direction.
Of course, Elizabeth's brother could have just missed out on the genetic lottery, too. So there may be other.
That's absolutely right, Neil. And I think it should be said here, as always, and this is maybe one place that I would diverge from your earlier guest, Eric Wilson, is that there's enormous human variation. And one of the messages I'd like to give is just that we be respectful of that variation. There isn't any right way to be here. It's not better to be a more melancholic person or a somewhat happier person, as long as you have some connection with your meaning system and you can feel sad when things aren't going well, feel happy when they are going well. There's enormous variation, and some people are more resilient and naturally just don't feel sadness as deeply.
Here's an email we got from Brian in Salt Lake City in Utah. I just wanted to mention the concepts of embracing sadness as an integral part of life is a very Buddhist concept. The Dalai Lama has several books on this subject, and I couldn't agree more about how accepting pain as a part of life will create better joy, or at least a better appreciation of happiness.
I think that's right. And there is, as many listeners have said, as Eric Wilson suggested, by listening to the information in your negative emotions, you can be wiser about your own life, about your nature, about what you care about, and therefore, I guess in the long run, actually achieve greater happiness.
Jerome Wakefield, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Jerome Wakefield, University professor at New York University. His book is titled The Loss of Sadness, How Psychiatry Transformed Normal Sorrow into Depressive Disorder. He was with us from our bureau in New York. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the sad state of the American romantic comedy. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.